Greenbelt, would you please give a fantastic welcome to Ray Hancock?
Hi, good afternoon, lovely, lovely, warm Greenbelt people. Greenbelt is, along with Berlin, the two places in the world that people sit next to me, even when there are spaces free. So it's so nice. People have been sitting next to me all day. I'm going to talk to you today about comic books. I'm going to talk to you about religion. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about education. I'm a secondary RE teacher, and I'm going to kind of muddle that all in together. Hopefully, you'll enjoy what I've got to say. Can I just get a little quick, because I'm a teacher, need to make people put their hands up. Can I have a quick show of hands of people who have, at some point in their life, seen a comic book? Excellent. Can you keep your hands up if you currently read comic books? Ooh, nice. Okay, brilliant. Okay, then. So I'm going to do like a little bit of kind of dipping our toes into the theory behind comic books and how they work in order to convince those of you who don't read comic books that you should. And then I'm going to talk about what it can tell us about our religious lives. So comics are, by their nature, a visual medium. So I can't show you any examples. So you're going to have to rely on my really bad descriptive skills and kind of wild gesturing and your fantastic imaginations. At the very least, maybe you'll go and read some just to work out what on earth I was on about. There's quite a nerdy discussion in academia about precisely what a comic is, how you can define it. But for the purposes of today, it's essentially a combination of complementary images and text contained in panels, which are usually drawn boxes, and arranged in a sequential narrative order. These panels capture static images, a moment in time. But how long that moment is depends on what the artist has chosen to include and exclude, and what the reader brings to it in terms of their imagination. So, for example, imagine a character standing in the rain talking to herself. The image is fixed, it's static. But we understand as readers that in the time that it takes her to think or talk the sentence in the speech bubble, time has passed, rain has fallen. Each of these panels is then separated usually by a blank space, which is fantastically called the gutter. But really, in the gutter is where all the magic about comics happens, because this is the bit that we have to fill in. This is the bit where we have to kind of narrate ourselves. So our character standing outside, if we imagine in the preceding panel, she was indoors. So somewhere in that space, she's got herself outside. And for each of you reading that comic, you're imagining a whole wonderful different possibilities. Did she go downstairs? Did she open a door? How many doors did she open? How long did it take her? So in that tiny blank space, you have already filled in so much extra than what the artist and the author has already given you. So comics don't just kind of happen at you like film or animation. You are required to participate. They demand it from you. And with that participation comes a certain degree of control. However, they're not all just a kind of random collection of meaning that we bring ourselves and individual interpretations. Images themselves are a shared common language. And so artists use images as shorthand to communicate ideas. So in our character standing in the rain will be drawn as diagonal dashes across the page. Each artist will render those differently, but we understand that it's rain. You can also use that visual shorthand, therefore, to communicate much more complex ideas. And so from that, we can get some idea of kind of what our shared religious language and religious imagery and representation might be. So imagine a different panel this time. You've got a cloud stretching the width of the panel at the top, and you've got four heads at the bottom looking up. A speech bubble descends from the cloud, and it says, "This is my son, who I love deeply. Listen to him." the placement of the speech bubble immediately tells us we're dealing with a higher power, right? The language and the text and the context kind of around that panel gives us the idea that this is the voice of God speaking. This is God speaking to the disciples. And this is the transfiguration as told by Mark and retold in this case by the Catholic author Jean Luen Yang in his fantastic Rosary comic book, which I'm going to talk about a bit later on. So a different panel in a different story can show us prayer, divine intervention, revelation, loss of faith, gaining of faith, all because comics are sharing this visual language. So, with all of this, what can comics tell us about our religious lives? I reckon they can do a bunch of things. I think they can transport us to other times and other places and show us other people, their inner beliefs and their outer practices. I reckon they can tell us how religious people themselves choose to represent themselves, their faith and their religion. They can remind us of our power and our responsibilities. They can reflect to us our morality, our stance on good and evil and the kind of murky grey bits. They can tell us how we wish to interpret and approach sacred texts. They can expose us to perspective-altering counter-narratives. And they can allow us to practice our reactions in private. So, this idea of transporting ourselves to other times, other places. Reading comics like literature, like film, can give us access to otherwise inaccessible people and experiences. And particularly for me as a teacher, this is how I use them in my classroom. And it can open our eyes to diverse religious beliefs and practices. So, for example, Guy DeLisi's fantastic ethnographic comic book, Jerusalem, is really useful to me in the classroom. DeLisi's wife works for MSF, so she goes off to places of extreme conflict, and Guy, a journalist, kind of goes in tow, and he writes some really beautiful comic books, which is him essentially wandering around and trying to make sense of what he sees. So he comes from a non-religious perspective, and so he's looking at Jerusalem and presenting it as kind of the vibrant cultural city that it is. But he's also trying to make sense of the religious geography and the religious practices that he sees. So he shows us festivals, he shows us observances, he shows us these outer practices. And crucially, he tries to make sense and give some context to three faiths attempting to coexist in a city that's sacred to all of them. And so we, the reader, can kind of learn along with him as he wanders around the city. And so one of the great features of comic books is that they can show both the inner and the outer world. In Guy DeLisi's Jerusalem, he very much narrates it, so we get his inner thoughts, but we don't get the inner thoughts of anybody else who appears in the book. When you think of that idea of thought bubbles versus speech bubbles. Thought bubbles and speech bubbles can work in harmony. They can work in discord, so they can show us a confliction within a character. So most of the stuff I'm talking about today is predominantly Christian, but it would just be unforgivable of me to talk about religion and comic books without talking about the most fantastic Ms. Marvel series by G. Willow Wilson. It's now in its third volume in trade paperback. Superheroes often pass their mantle or their powers to new people or bring kind of fresh blood into the family. And Wilson gives the powers of Captain Marvel to Kamala Khan, a Muslim American teenager. And so through this brilliantly fantastic, genuine like superhero comic book, we are confronted with prejudice. We're confronted with information about halal and haram food, behavior, cultural othering, stereotyping, and ultimately kind of how a young teenager wrestles with their faith, their sense of identity, and their place in the world. And Wilson unashamedly makes Kamala's faith the center of her character, be it her questioning her drive of how to save the world or desperately trying to come up with a costume which is more than just the traditional swimsuit. When she doubts herself, she finds guidance. Her parents on one occasion are really worried that their daughter is really up to something. She keeps disappearing out at night. Who wouldn't be worried about that? And so they send her to speak to the imam, and Kamala's really expecting a lecture. Instead, he tells her, If you insist on doing this thing that you will not tell me about, do it with the qualities befitting an upright young woman. Courage, strength, honesty, compassion, and self-respect. That's something I'm happy to expose my students to. So in this sense, comics can be educational. And if you're like me and you believe that a lot of fear is driven by understanding, learning can be something incredibly powerful. Comics can tell us about how religious people themselves choose to represent themselves and their faith in the outer world. And in the recent years, there's been a real influx of kind of autobiographical, semi-autobiographical comics, or graphic novels, as some people choose to call them. And there isn't really, well, I don't know, we can argue about it in the questions. As far as I'm concerned, there isn't really a good definition of what is a graphic novel. But it's for those of you who don't know, it's essentially a way of saying, I'm a sophisticated adult, I read big books that happen to have pictures in them, please still want to sleep with me. So one of the most fantastic ones is Please God Find Me a Husband by Simone Lear. It's great. I nearly didn't pick it up off the shelf. I thought, but no, it's really good. She's a Roman Catholic. She reaches her 34th birthday and decides she's got to get her life in gear. She says to God, to cut to the chase, God, I'm going to be 34 in 2 weeks' time. And if you want me to marry someone, you're going to need to get a bit of a move on. She promptly then goes on a religious and spiritual quest that takes her to Australia. It takes her to living in community with nuns. She imagines herself in the tale of Zacchaeus. She imagines herself dancing and singing and praying and, importantly, playing Operation with Jesus. And ultimately, the book ends, I won't kind of tell you like what she finds out, but it ends with her and God riding off into the sunset on BMXs and God is popping a wheelie. So whether we agree with her depiction of deity or not, what she's doing is presenting a really considered, really authentic and personal representation of her Catholicism. Similarly, Jean Luen Yang, who I mentioned earlier, he happily weaves his Catholicism into his very famous book now, American Born Chinese, which is a tale of school alienation and prejudice and being an immigrant in a new country. Interestingly, though, he takes a lot of his inspiration from his Buddhist childhood and his Buddhist culture. And he unashamedly weaves those in. So what he does is he takes the tale of Monkey King and the journey to the West and weaves that in with the kind of everyday prejudice that his protagonist, Jin, is facing at school. But he twists it. He's happy to twist it. And in the tale, Monkey is faced with his creator, who I will now butcher the name of. Zhe Yaozu, he who is. And Zhe Yaozu forces Monkey to confront his true nature. And he says to him, in words that I'm hoping will be familiar, I have searched your soul, little monkey. I know your most hidden thoughts. It was I who formed your inmost being. I who knit you together in the womb. And Monkey's journey to the West concludes not with the traditional receipt of Buddhist scriptures, but with Monkey being present at the nativity. And so Yang is quite comfortable with the syncretic nature of his personal faith. He blends pantheism, he blends Buddhism, he blends Christianity. Our reaction to that is also something worthy of examination, I think. Are we okay with that? Are we okay with what he's doing with God and where he's putting God in this story? It's also worth looking at Yang's The Rosary comic book, which he wrote himself as a Lent activity. And it's the luminous mysteries presented as a comic. And it's designed to teach young children about how to pray the rosary, but it can also be prayed as the rosary. So it has long panels for the Our Father beads, and it has smaller panels for the Hail Marys. And so in and of itself, it's a comic book that's kind of a performative act of prayer and worship as well. Craig Thompson, in his semi-autobiographical Blankets, which is a very serious book because it's nearly 600 pages. That's how you know it's serious. So you could get it and just put it on your coffee table and make you look good. So it's a coming-of-age tale where Craig, as a character, goes to a religious camp and kind of breaks away from his fundamentalist Christian family, finds love, questions kind of his relationship with God, questions liberal and literal interpretations of scripture, and ultimately moves away from the faith of his family, much to their disappointment, but builds his own personal relationship with creation. There are lots of other fantastic comic books that I could mention that wrestle with the really big questions in life, death, and the universe. It's worth looking at the webcomic Sordid City Blues, in which Christians themselves kind of wrestle with the answers or not that Christianity provides. And it would be very unfair of me not to mention Alison Bechdel, who is not explicitly a religious author, but she most certainly deals with really big issues of death and grief and skeletons in our family relationships in her books Fun Home and Are You My Mother? And also, if you're not already using it, you should be using the Bechdel test in order to decide whether a film is gender biased or not. It doesn't tell you at all whether the film is good, and you'd be surprised the number of films that pass it. But in order to determine whether a film is gender biased or not, you need to have at least two named female characters who talk to each other about something other than men. So many films are already failing at this part. Try it. Go out, try it. I mean, it's horrendous which one's passed, but anyway, go try it. So what all of these have in common is that they are people of faith choosing how they wish to represent their religion, represent their inner beliefs and their outer practices. And so that in turn can provoke us to reflect on how we choose to represent ourselves and how we want to be seen out in the world. Comics can remind us of our power and our responsibilities. It would be really, really remiss of me to talk about comics and religion without saying, with great power comes great responsibility. We, as readers, have a huge amount of power. We can hear the thoughts of our characters. We can manipulate time by flicking backwards and forwards through the story. And we can invent different courses of action to take our characters from panel to panel. And on the rare occasions that characters, say like Deadpool, break that fourth wall, they remind us that we are viewers of otherwise self-contained universes. When we are readers, we are powerful. Nonetheless, we're not without responsibilities too. In a very sweet way, we have a responsibility to the characters when we read them and when we take them out into the world and recommend them to our friends and say, hey, you should really read this. And we kind of grow with them and grow their backstory. But in a bigger way, we have a responsibility as consumers of comics. What we read, where we buy it, what we buy, and who we support by consuming these comics or using them in our communities and our churches. Comics can also reflect power and responsibility back to us. Those of you who are really familiar with comics will have no problem with the idea that the Incredible Hulk and Bruce Banner represent the very best and very worst of what it means to be human. It's our spiritual and psychological struggle. So as a modern day Jekyll and Hyde, he's exposed to gamma radiation, and whenever Bruce Banner becomes angry, he hulks out. By identifying with these characters, we acknowledge that we each have parts of ourselves that we view as ugly or shameful or out of control. And that we can then, through him, confront the battle between our desperate, desperate drive to be accepted and the heartbreaking difficulty that we have in accepting ourselves. We are powerful, but we are also responsible. After all, who is going to clean up the carnage after we physically, psychologically, emotionally, or spiritually hulk out? Comics can tell us about our morality, our stance on good and evil and the grey bits. I think it's probably an idea that you're all familiar with, this idea that we need the stories about good versus evil to remind ourselves that when life gets a bit too much, that sometimes it can be simple. Sometimes good does win. The goodies win. They beat the baddies. The day is saved. And comics can give us that. I mean, Superman is always going to win. Even when he dies, he's going to come back and he's going to win. And the child in us hopes that he's going to come back. And the cynical adult knows that there is no way that DC would let him die when he makes them so much money. It's the American dream, eh? Even if Superman were to become too powerful, we have Batman, Batman has made it his mission to find ways to bring Superman down should he need to. He is the checks and balances. And so good triumphs over evil and balance is restored. However, comics can give us a playground for safely experimenting with blurring these boundaries between good and evil. Some of the most popular superheroes, like Batman, allow us to test our own moral mettle. How far is he, how far are we, prepared to go to protect the innocent, to protect our country, protect the world, protect the universe? What do we do when the law and justice clash? Now, it's very important, I think, at this point, that you're not under the illusion that I like Batman at all. Much to the horror of my students, I really, really don't like him. My innermost being loathes him. And the reasons are many, many, and convoluted and exacerbated by alcohol. But I can summarize them in two ways. One is the guy just needs a hug, you know? He needs a hug and maybe some very expensive therapy, and he should be encouraged to invest his money in social welfare programs rather than running around and kind of criminalizing the mentally ill. And frankly, he really should take better care of his wards and poor, poor Alfred, who, if we're honest, does all the work. But the second one is the one that I think is important today. For me, Batman is just far too small picture. And to try and explain this, I'll compare him to two other superhero vigilantes who are in very similar circumstances. So Tony Stark, Iron Man, is also a billionaire playboy who relies on tech in lieu of any kind of actual superpowers. However, he is the polar opposite of Bruce Wayne, apart from the fact that he's happy and having fun. He's a flawed optimist, and he's firmly focused on the big picture. He's all about saving the universe. And if any of you have seen the most recent Avengers film, almost all of the carnage and catastrophe is caused because he is focused too much on the big picture. In comparison, Batman is just concerned essentially with local crime. I mean, he spends some time with the Justice League, but he kind of hangs around the background. He's a bit too cool for school. He doesn't really want to play with them. He'd much rather just go back to Gotham and kind of knock around with the Joker. Now, in the middle, we have my own personal favourite superhero. The most fantastic. And if you don't leave this tent convinced that he's the best, then I'm just going to go home and cry. The Green Arrow. Or, as he is known in his very successful TV show, Arrow. So, Oliver Queen is also a billionaire playboy who, in different versions of his story, loses his family. When he loses his fortune, he's driven to kind of adopt this sort of Robin Hood type persona. And so he becomes a social activist who also gets himself elected as mayor and really does roll out all of those social welfare programs that Batman should have done. And he still fights crime. And he finds time to battle the Global League of Assassins and confront the drug addiction of his sidekick along with the Green Lantern in the 70s. And he died and came back to life. I love him. But I love him mainly because he is concerned with the middle picture. And there are times in my life where I can cope with kind of the enormity of the human condition, my place in the universe, and the idea that maybe one day we can all just kind of get along and it will be great. And then other times it just becomes too much. And I look around and I see the fear and the violence. And I don't know what to do. And the only thing that I feel I can do is to try and make a tiny, tiny local difference. And for me, often, that's going to the supermarket and refusing to use the self-checkout and instead buying my shopping from a person, even if it means I have a rich and monosyllabic exchange with them. Do you want Rizzler? Yeah, okay. That's brilliant. That's me. I'm winning. But let's be honest. The most engaging characters, really, in superhero narratives are the villains. And, you know, we'll often say it's because they've got the best outfits and they get the best lines and they kind of swank around, you know, kind of act with, you know, impunity and just generally look really cool. And that is the case. But I also think it's because deep down we identify with them. We identify with their mistakes. We are all products of a backstory, yet we are still responsible for our actions. We are flawed as human beings and we make terrible choices and sometimes we get it so, so wrong. And through villains, we can see ourselves stopped. And often we can see ourselves offered the possibility of redemption. are we Professor Xavier of the X-Men or are we Magneto? Both men have the shared moral vision that oppression and persecution of mutants must stop. For Magneto, it's at all costs. And when I find myself on the margins, when I find myself feeling isolated, when people won't sit next to me on the bus, when I struggle to live in a world of fear and suspicion, I'm pretty confident, given the power, I would probably do as Magneto does. Maybe I would flip between desperately trying to live in community or running off and isolating myself on a Genosha island or just wanting everybody gone, wiped out. I should be Professor X. I probably would be Magneto. So reading comics, like all good literature, can hold a mirror up to us and to the morality in the big and the small and the medium pictures. And they can arguably give us role models, modern day saints, if you will, to help us live as we should. Comics can tell us how to approach sacred texts. Comic books are often used to kind of adapt or retell or reimagine religious stories and sacred texts. And I'm kind of hoping that all day you've been thinking, oh, comics and religions, comic book Bibles. I can't wait to go along and hear about that. And there are many, many comic book Bibles out there, many. But they are not all created equal. And they vary in quality and they vary in motivation. And I think it's worth pausing for a moment and trying to kind of unpick those possible motivations. So to oversimplify it, we have two. One, the creators of these comic books have thought, oh, I only wish that there was a sophisticated medium that combined image and text in innovative ways and that required the reader to participate in the co-creation of meaning. That way, I could adapt the Bible to this medium and not only offer a different but no less meaningful way for Bible fans, because essentially religion is the ultimate fandom, right? For Bible fans to engage with the text, but also bring in new and discerning readers, if only. Sigh. Now, there are definitely comic book Bibles out there that fit that bill. Siku, who's spoken at Greenbelt before, I think is a really good example. His manga Bible, or as my mum calls it, the Jenga Bible. I was really confused. She kept going, are you reading that Jenga Bible? I don't know. It'd be more like Stonehenge, wouldn't it? I don't know. Anyway, the manga Bible. As a comic book artist, he really takes care of his panels. They are beautifully, beautifully presented. And as a theologian, he is unashamed about what he's doing, and he references his text, and he explains his choices to readers. And so engaging with these texts can help us kind of reflect on our own personal theology. How do we feel about the artist's depiction of the divine, of the geography, of the history? How do we feel, for example, about Siku's choice of the words from John, it is finished, for his crucifixion scene, but directing his readers to Matthew 27 if they want to know more? However, in the absence of a comic book Bible like this, the second possibility becomes increasingly likely. Consider this really fantastic blurb from the back of them. I'm not going to name which one it is, in case anybody was involved in it, will undoubtedly attract thousands of children, boys in particular, who would otherwise never have touched the good book. Like, oh, it's really horrible. I don't even, like, where do I begin with something like that? For a start, not just my genitals, but my entire being is offended by the idea that comics are particularly for boys. I think comics are like by no means a sexism-free zone, and those of you who read them will know that there are writers out there who just spoil it for everybody by producing more and more violence, particularly against women, in order to show that the villain is really, really evil, or that the male character has grown and developed, what is known as the women in fridges, or women in refrigerators phenomena. There are also, though, a real significant number of women who are involved in the industry. And what figures there are suggests that actually women make up almost half, if not more, of the current comic book consuming population. So making something a comic doesn't automatically mean that it will apply to boys or girls or the gender fluid or whoever. For me as well, this second possibility really kind of smacks of the sinister feel of tricking, specifically children, into reading the Bible. And it's tricking because, you know, like, reading the Bible's really hard. It's got, like, words, and it's big, and it's effort, and it's long. So wouldn't it be better if we could make it brightly coloured and cut out most of the words, and there'll be pictures in there, and everybody will be really overstimulated by it, and maybe even we could just, you know, present it as a single narrative. That would be fine. In fact, we could probably move the order around. Nobody would notice. And you'd have to be really stupid not to be able to read a comic book. And if you're not mesmerised by all those bright colours, then you're probably grown up enough to be reading the real thing. It's like sneaking vitamins into really brightly coloured cereal for kids, which totally misses the point, because kids are really sophisticated consumers. And what's actually happening is adults like me just completely binging on Cocoa Pops and Frosties and, you know, all of those others, while still being really gripped with a sense of my own mortality and kind of chugging multivitamins until I'm sort of like, my system is flooded with beta-carotene or whatever that is. So it completely misses the point. A number of comic book Bibles, I believe, do devalue the medium and the sacred text and the reader. And so next time you come across one, I really encourage you to question the motives of the creators and demand the same integrity and rigour from your comic books as you would from your novels, because you are a sophisticated Greenbelt audience, so you're already doing that with all of the other mediums that you're reading, you're engaging with. It's also worth, before I move on, mentioning that there's some really good retellings out there. There's the fantastic Marked, which is Steve Ross's take on the Gospel of Mark. And then just like the brilliantly loopy Flight of Fancy, which is punk rock Jesus. It's Sean Murphy's tale of a Jesus clone reanimated by corporate America to bring about the second coming. It's quite violent and it's got some bad language in, so it's not really for kids, but it's really interesting. It's very thought-provoking. And so these stories can kind of challenge and enlighten us and deepen our relationships to sacred texts. And I think open us to the possibility of counter-narratives. And these counter-narratives are things that can alter our perspective. So they're new takes on old, beloved stories and characters, taking well-known events and giving them a twist. And my favourite religious comic book counter-narrative at the moment is Tom Gould's Goliath. In it, Goliath of Gath is a gentle giant in the Philistine army. He goes out of his way to avoid conflict. He does whatever he can to swap his guard duty for duty in the stores or admin shifts, and he's happiest with his abacus. You kind of get the impression that he'd rather be anywhere other than the army. But Goliath is used by his captain in a plan to curry favour with the king and as a kind of ultimate super weapon to bring about an early end to the war. And so he has a suit of special armour made for him. He gets a little shield bearer, and the two of them, every day, trek out into kind of no man's land. And they spend much of the book just waiting and chatting, and every now and then reluctantly kind of issuing the challenge. And at one point the boy asks him, "Do you think anybody will come?" And Goliath replies, "I hope not." He's never shown as the willing aggressor, and you get a real heartbreaking sense of the futility of it. And in an interesting reversal, when the challenge is finally met, it's David who's presented as this one-dimensional killer. He kind of emerges menacingly from the mist, kind of ranting about smiting and kind of gnashing his teeth. And never once does he engage his opponent in conversation or as a person. In this respect, Goliath is the cog in every war machine. He's a character worthy of identification and empathy. And his counter-narrative forces us to engage further with the Bible and to confront the reality of our enemies. So here's a thought. If comics can alter our perspective of art, as well as religious stories, what if we read religious art as if it was a comic book? Consider Stations of the Cross. The last days of Christ presented to us as static images. Images that are separated by distance and time, be they plaques on the wall of your church or, say, the Wintershall stations in Surrey, which are all sculptures kind of placed along a country walk. Each panel captures a specific moment in time, and the length of that time depends on the narration and the action that we choose to add to it and how we animate the scene in our minds. And between panels, we are left to physically traverse the gutter and given time and space to contemplate and create our own imaginative, meaningful interaction with the story. So in a way, the Stations of the Cross are kind of the ultimate immersive, interactive, religious comic book, one that we can step completely into. So I encourage you to seek out new ways to challenge your perspective on life. Maybe reading counter-narrative stories of a religious flavour might be one of the ways. Or maybe reading something, if it was a comic, might be another one. Comics can allow us to practice our reactions in private. And I think this, along with kind of the sacred text, is potentially kind of one of the more controversial things that I'm saying today. One of the almost completely unique features of comics is that because they have been around for years, we have beloved characters that have stuck around for years because they're owned by the publishing houses, but they're frequently reinvented by new creative teams and new authors and new artists. The downside of that is that's often the very thing that stops people from actually picking up a comic. So, for example, you want to read The Flash? Well, which version of The Flash do you want to read? Are you reading original Jay Garrick? Are you reading the more famous Barry Allen, whose story became so confusing that eventually they had to kill him off just to make it stop? Or maybe it's Flash when he was Wally West, or Flash when he was Bart Allen? Or is it okay to kind of start from The Flash, the TV show, also really good? Or is the continuity all wrong? It's really confusing. And we become so worried that there's a right way and a wrong way to read comics or to be a fan that can stop us from even starting. But one of the real upsides of this kind of changing continuity and changing characters is that it can push our much-loved heroes and villains into new situations, and it can give us new versions of themselves. And that, in turn, gives us an opportunity, I think, to practice our reactions in private. So, for example, in 2011, DC performed one of many, this happens a lot, system resets, and brought a whole load of characters out from storage and decided to reinvent some new ones. There was 52 of them, so they launched the new 52 series, it was called. And so one of them was Alan Scott, who at one time had been Green Lantern. Only this time they brought him back and he was gay. A beloved friend who you haven't seen for years turns up, tells you he's gay. More specifically, he turns up and tells you that his boyfriend was killed in a train crash and that consequently has superpowers, but everybody's allowed to freak out about that. So what do you do? How do you react? And the point is, it doesn't matter because it's just between you and the comic. And it gives you an opportunity to practice your reaction in private. Very recently over in Marvel, Jane Foster picked up Mjolnir and became Thor, God of Thunder. Not Lady Thor, not Thorina, not Thor Girl, actual Thor, with hammer, everything, in her own series called Thor. So on one hand, we have Thor currently being played in the Marvel Cinematic Universe on screen by the very, very lovely, shapely Chris Hemsworth. And then we got Thor as a woman. Her gender presentation is female. She identifies as a woman. What do you do? How do you react? The point is, it doesn't matter because it's between you and the comic and you can practice your reactions in private. Now, sadly, in both of these cases, some people didn't take the time to practice their reactions in private and instead vomited kind of confused, hateful bile all over the internet. You guys are much better than that and you can take the time. And it's okay to give yourself the freedom to have a little freak out about it. Because when, for example, we encounter LGBT issues in our daily lives, we will react differently. The person coming out to you has placed an enormous amount of trust in you at the most vulnerable time in their lives, and there is so much pressure to get it right. It's okay to freak out in private. But it's not just gender and sexuality that comics can challenge us with. They can also ask, for example, the question, how much freedom are you willing to give up in name of security? And so those of you who read Marvel will know of the Civil War storyline. It was kind of massive crossover event that brought in lots and lots of characters and lots of different storylines, superheroes and supervillains, and pitched them against each other. And so in a post-9/11 world, the world leaders had said, hang on a minute, this is not on. We got people running around, capes, masks, secret identities. This has got to stop. Anybody could be doing this. This has got to stop. And so what they decided to do was to bring in superhero registration. The superheroes needed to declare their secret identities and register themselves as good, upstanding citizens. After all, if you have nothing to hide, then you've got nothing to fear. Tony Stark, Iron Man, comes out in favour of registration. And interestingly, Captain America comes out against in a kind of stance that ends up leading to his death. But of course, he'll be back because money. But reading storylines like this can they mirror in a very sinister way our political landscape. And so if we've chosen to identify with role models, if we've had those modern day saints, we can follow those choices. We can practice our reactions to that in private, which is in itself an argument for privacy. So hopefully, I've now utterly convinced you that not only are comics incredibly serious, but also brilliantly frivolous, and are a valuable medium, and you should all be going out and reading them and sharing them with people and kind of questioning and critiquing them and acknowledging that there is, you know, a kind of strong religious voices out there who are choosing to represent themselves. And maybe you'll want to go and read some of those as well. And you'd hopefully, yeah, you've got time to ask me some questions, but only nice ones, please. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ray. Actually, I have a question for you.
You're allowed.
And then we'll run, yeah, run round.
You get first dibs.
Okay. One character that comes to mind for me is the Vision, who basically artificial life form created, who develops a sense of purpose and a sense of morals. I wonder what your take is on that.
Ooh. I think characters like that are always really interesting because... What seems to be kind of coming a theme for some of the stuff I've heard today at Greenbelt as well is, like, how do we define personhood? I think personally, for myself, characters like that tend not to be ones that I bring into the classroom, just because you've got to kind of be bringing a lot of your own philosophy and a lot of kind of pre-thought to it, and actually kind of getting kids to deal with that in an hour is challenging at most. I have to say, I'm not a fan of the Vision. Controversial, I don't know. I think maybe it's because I don't consider him a person. Ooh. I think I need to go and have a little chat with myself. So yes, personhood for everybody apart from the Vision, who is not a person. I don't know, does that answer your question?
Yeah. Anybody else?
Thank you. As somebody who's grown up with the likes of Tintin and Asterix and so on, and then read a lot of the Japanese stuff, there's so much out there, including a lot of underground publications. I've been to America and found things in bookshops that I've never come across before. Now, some of the so-called, like, more spiritual, let's say, publications, how do you find this stuff? Is there some medium or actually a way of being able to find the good stuff? And knowing what whether you're looking at, because there is so much out there.
Yeah.
So
that's a really good question. I mean, so in kind of my scholarly work, I'm attached to the University of Oxford. So obviously the natural inclination is I shall go to the Bodleian Library. You know, it's the best library. Well, Oxford would say it's the best library in the world. It's not. But, you know, it supposedly has, you know, every version of every book printed in the English language. Rubbish. It's rubbish. I mean, it's partly because their cataloguing system is so bad. But I found actually, every single book that I've talked to you about, I have found in my local library. Yay, local libraries. So I think that's the first place to go, is just go and just peruse your local library and just pull stuff off the shelf and give it a go. Because you're not buying it. You don't have to even walk out with it. You can flick the flute and go, no, put it back on the shelf. So, for example, for some people, Garth Ennis and his series Preacher has some very interesting depictions of deity in it. It is also very adult, and it is designed to offend. You can put that back on the shelf if you want. So definitely big up local libraries. Most of this stuff now kind of lives on the internet and kind of internet communities and stuff. Sacred and Sequential is a really good kind of scholarly website that will kind of talk about the new stuff that's coming out. Comics Grid as well, the work of A. David Lewis. He's very much kind of a leader in the field of religion and comics. So yeah, so I would say local libraries definitely first, then go to the internet, and then go to a few scholars, but not all of them, because some of them are quite boring. Does that help?
Thank you. Yeah, it helps.
I'm resisting the urge to kind of... I really want to be a teacher, and I want to be...
I can go over there if you like.
Yeah, can you just kick off a bit? No, go for it. What's your question?
I just wondered what your thoughts were on the explosion of the Superman analogy in Sunday sermons. It kind of, about 5-10 years ago, seemed to be everywhere, seemed to be a little bit easy, but just wondered on your thoughts.
Yeah, no, I think, I mean, it's interesting that there are two kind of characters that get wheeled out when you're talking about kind of, yeah, the analogies with Christ and stuff. And obviously one of them is Superman and the other one is the Silver Surfer in terms of some, you know, and both of them, to be honest, are quite tenuous. I think there's stuff there that you can use. But I think as with anything, like particularly things like comic book Bibles, I think it's worth questioning why you're using them. So, you know, one of sort of the comments I've had from kind of my education colleagues is, hey, Ray, aren't you just using comic books in the classroom because comics are cool and, you know, kids need cool things to be tricked into learning? And the answer to that is, well, I'm using comic books because I love them and I think they're valid. But also, you're pretty much guaranteed, any of you who are teachers, that anything you do instantly becomes deeply uncool in the eyes of students. So when you're bringing them in as materials. So in terms of kind of Superman and the analogies that go with it, if it's coming from somebody who's really engaged with that and really thought it through, I'm like, go for it. You could possibly use different, but go for it. If it's just being wheeled out because comics are cool and make people listen, I think that's not really fair to your listeners or to comic books. Does that help?
Since we're talking about religion and comics, do you have any thoughts on The Wiccan Divine by Kieran Gillen?
Like all the feelings. If you haven't, yeah, I mean, there's so much that I could have talked about. The Wiccan and the Divine, I'm guessing you're into, yeah, brilliant. So The Wicked and the Divine is, I'm going to just do a butchered, like, précis of it now. It's a really, really fantastic comic book. It's fantastic because of the story, but it's also beautifully, beautifully drawn. For the most part set in England. The main character kind of lives in Broccoli, which is very exciting. And it's this idea that every cycle of years, gods are reborn in the bodies of teenagers and young people. And so for a year, they live as gods. And they live in the kind of the modern age as pop stars and media stars. And then they die. That's it. Kind of flame snuffed out. And so it's a really kind of personal engagement with this idea of deity and kind of what it means to have that thrust upon you or to have people idolize you, but what it means to also kind of be left out of that and to find yourself as one of the followers. So yeah, I heart it with all my heart. But I didn't include it in this because I thought it's broader religion. Likewise, Saga, Fiona Staples and Brian Vaughan's series is just, you could just eat it all up. It's just amazing. And it has kind of religious elements, but like kind of with the Vision, you need to kind of dip a little bit deeper into it. But yeah, I love it so much.
You mentioned about having trouble knowing where to start with more mainstream comics, and I was wondering if you had any advice for that, and I also wanted to share my personal bit of advice about that. Pick something, and if you don't understand something, Google it, because whilst you can't just what the internet says, with comics you can.
Yeah, I think I'd have to agree with you. I think, yeah, just like I said, you know, go to your library, go along the shelves, grab something that appeals to you and start reading it. And you may find, you know, you Google it and you find that actually, well, this is, you know, the third incarnation of this particular character and it, you know, it was Silver Age and blah, blah, blah. And you can do that reading if you want. And I think that is something about kind of nerddom and geekdom that, like, we can't help but absorb all of those little facts. But you also don't have to. And I think, you know, if anybody comes up to you and says, well, you know, I sort of want to do like a pseudo geeky voice, like, you can't be reading that because you haven't read it from the beginning of the theory. Then I have issue one of, go away. Like, just go back to your mother's basement, you know? Like, I'll read whatever I like, you know? I'm a grown-up, I can eat cereal for dinner, and I can read whatever comic book I like at any point in the series, you know? So tell people to go away. So hopefully that answers your question. I think we're in agreement with that one.
However, are you familiar with the Avengers in the 1970s, around about issue 114?
To the basement with you, sir.
Where the Vision gets engaged to the Scarlet Witch, who is a former villainess herself, villain, I guess, yeah. And is immediately set upon. The Avengers Mansion is besieged by rabid fundamentalist suicide bombers in the 1970s. It's amazing. And they're writing hate mail, and one of them writes a message to Captain America, still the Avengers generally, and says, "And God did not make androids."
It wasn't me that wrote that letter. No,
but it's one of the best panels I ever saw in a comic when I was a teenager, because Captain America takes this letter and he crumples it up and he throws it in the fire and saying, "My God is a God of love." And that came in a Marvel comic, Stan Lee type time. I think it was probably Roy Thomas or Steve Englehart wrote it, but...
I definitely changed my life. I need to find that. Also, I'd found out recently that Marvel had done they've done some series of retellings of religious stories, and they'd also done a series which I think made it to three issues called The Illuminator, which is like heavily kind of religious Christian story. I haven't read it. I've got the first two issues, and they kind of arrived in the post, and I thought I should probably be practicing my Greenbelt talk. I'll leave them. So I don't know. Read them. They look like they're really good. You know, you can get them quite cheap secondhand. But yeah, there's so much out there. And, you know, even things like those of you who read Eagle comic. I mean, I occasionally read Eagle sort of, you know, very, very late on into its run. But Dan Dare was originally pitched to be a space chaplain. That's what he was going to be. And the whole series is created by an Anglican priest. And I think those of you who read it would remember better, but I think allegedly it had sort of Bible stories and the story of John as a comic book on the back pages. Like, this stuff has been around for years, so I'm late to the party.
I'm just wondering if Stan Lee is hiding here somewhere. He normally has a cameo about now, doesn't he? Yeah, so.
Hi, I grew up on Eagle. And I chose it because Girl was so manky. Eagle had much better stories.
Yep.
I progressed to things like reading Joseph Campbell and was really glad when Star Wars was based on the hero myth. And I just wonder whether, all the experimentation, I think it's entirely creative freedom and it's great, but do you actually need for inner health to have stories that have the right shape and really tackle the hero myth with integrity?
Ah, that's a really good question. Yes. I think, first of all, excellent choice of early comic books. As much as I say, you know, comics are not... shouldn't be for kind of boys or girls, but some of the early girls' comic books are just awful. It's awful. I would say, for the most part, I think even with the messing and the kind of the change, some of the changes in continuity and the kind of playing with characters and stuff, I think for the most part, the hero myth is still kind of the bones of it and the framework of it. I think what's interesting is kind of as we move through kind of modernity and postmodernity is kind of who is our hero changes. But I think the structure for the most part remains the same. And I think that idea of who the hero is kind of adds to that idea of it kind of being intellectually and emotionally healthy, that actually we're becoming more inclusive with the idea of who the hero is, and so we don't need to have, you know, kind of rubbish girls comics and comics just for boys, and we can have characters that kind of mess with gender and the gender lines and things like that, and they can still fit the heroic motif. So yes, it is still important, but I think certainly from the stuff that I read, I believe that it's still there.
Hi, I really like Batman.
And
I was just thinking the difference between Batman and Superman is that Batman is psychologically more complex. But what I was hearing from you was that you were saying he was one-dimensional because he's kind of stuck. But isn't that the problem of continuity over a very long period of time? He's been around 75 years, and for the dramatic issues of the character to remain present, he can't heal. He can't grow. He's not allowed to, because you have to stay, you have to still have the dramatic kind of thing. And I wonder if that's one of the essential problems of the idea of comics as morality tales, which is, I believe they are in many ways, is that if you want a property to remain functional, there can be no psychological growth.
I think you're right. He is stuck, and I agree with you. I think that is important to the character. As much as I loathe him, he'd be deeply boring if he just got on with his life after me having hugged him and obviously sent him to therapy. I think though. Yes, I do think he's one-dimensional, and I do think he's stuck. But I think he's also he's varied in how he is one-dimensional. So kind of if you take sort of Adam West Batman, who actually I think is my favourite Batman, because he's just so ridiculous. And compare him to sort of, you know, Christian Bale, Nolan Batman, which is just like so, so tiresome and really serious, and I'm Batman. what I'm hoping, I mean, they're one-dimensional in two really different ways. And what I'm really hoping, I don't know about you guys, I'm really excited about Ben Affleck being Batman, because I'm really hoping he's kind of going to be like Adam West. I'm like, the circle is complete. I think I'll be disappointed, but I'll go and see it anyway. I think we sort of do. We do need them to be stuck a little bit. I think they can have small personal growth, and they can kind of learn from little situations and little mistakes, but ultimately, they do need to be stuck, which is really sad for them, I think as well. Like they don't get to grow, and I think the mark I think of how an author treats their character well is whether they really think about those little bits of personal growth and develop them, or they do the, you know, god awful women in fridges thing where, you know, In order to grow or to be angry about something awful has to happen to your girlfriend. Right. That's, yeah. So, yes.
I think we've got time for just one more. Anybody behind me? Down there, okay.
Sorry. Hello.
Hi there.
I'm with you about Batman, because Green Arrow changed, but that's another debate for another talk, for another festival.
It's not a debate, it just is. Like, Green Arrow is better than Batman.
But my question is that you've done a great job convincing this crowd, if anyone wasn't convinced before, that comic books can be a very viable source of analogy and explanation for things. And that you can look to comic books for lots of answers to complex questions and visualizations of them. But how do you explain that, maybe more shortly or more simply, to academics or to the people in your congregation or your group or whatever it is that are just going to scoff at you?
Nobody scoffs at me, do they?
Yeah, scoff at me.
Look at my face. This is not a face that you scoff at. Unless you're brave enough to sit next to me on the bus, and then you can scoff at me. Interestingly, sort of, I mean, so the two communities I tend to work in are the education community and the academic community, and they don't really talk to each other. Those of you who are teachers will know that. You get lots of papers published about stuff, and you're like, dude, have you ever been in a classroom? Like, what are you talking about? So it's really nice, because actually, I can just tell them whatever, and they believe me. So I go to the educators and I say, yeah, this is a deeply, deeply academic subject. It's very scholarly. It's very weighty. and therefore we need to bring it into our classrooms because, you know, participation, you know, involvement, we need to do it. And they're like, yeah, yeah, great, it's brilliant, this comic's cool, let's bring them in. And then I go to the academic community, I'm like, impact, real world impact, that's what you need for your funding proposals. We need to do stuff in the classroom. And they're like, oh, yeah, we'll do that. So, yeah, no, I haven't had anybody scoff to my face. And nobody's challenged me on the idea that you can bring comics into it. I mean, English have been doing it for years. I mean, the number of kind of Shakespeare adaptations that are out there. And, there's a real discussion about why you're bringing it in. Is it you bringing it in because you think that it's easy for people to read and we can kind of get our those who struggle with reading in? And I think the jury's still out on that. Those of you who've read comics know that actually reading comics is quite hard. It's a literacy that you have to learn. I just went on an educational rant there. Sorry, I went slightly off topic. No, I so far I haven't had anybody scoff at me, and I think partly that's due to sort of just being utterly convinced that this is a good idea, daring anybody to scoff.
Fantastic. Well, our time has come to an end. I think when I get home, I'll be digging out my dusty old box of Beano comics from the loft. So
yeah.
Have a reread. Yeah. Greenbelters, give your appreciation for Ray Hancock.